everyone, and welcome to The Art of Podcasting, episode number 6, post-production. This week, we're going to talk about the crucial steps for editing and packaging and distributing a podcast. Once you've got it recorded, then what? And so that's what this is all about this week. And my name is Mark Cockrell. Hi, everybody. And this week, we have one man down. We don't know what's going on, but Steve apparently couldn't be with us, and maybe he'll jump in later on in the show. But we do have with us the professor, the brain behind the organization, Mr. James Messer. Hey, James.
Howdy, howdy, Mark. How you doing?
I am okay. That's about all I can muster today.
Very good. Well, there's nothing wrong with that. That's better than most. And I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me again. And for those of you that don't usually, that or have not really seen the feed or know how all of this works, I just kind of show up. Mark's the guy behind the scenes who actually does all of the hard work of producing it and putting the MP3 together and creating the feeds and putting them out there. And then I just kind of hang up the phone afterwards, this Skype connection, and I go about my business. So thanks again for doing that.
Hey, no problem. You do occasionally put some pre-show effort into it.
Well, let's not go crazy with that. I try. I write some stuff down thinking maybe I'll talk about this, you know, drink a couple of beers, get a little hopped up, and then just do some pre-show.
So what's your favorite beer?
Oh, there's my favorite beer. The normal response there is free. Okay. That's my favorite. But all truth be told, I'm a big fan of anything from Magic Hat and Dogfish Breweries.
Yeah. See, none of that means anything. I'm
a beer snob. Yeah. So yes, I like those. There's particular kinds of beers I like. So it is a little bit esoteric.
See, for me, beer would be an effective punishment for violent crime. It's just, it's not a pleasant experience. I don't enjoy it at all.
I'm a big fan. So I just finished a number 9, which means the podcast will be exceptional this evening.
I actually don't like any fermented beverage of any kind.
Well, that's fine.
I'm at a restaurant and they have like a wine sauce with their pasta, I can't eat it. I don't like beer battered, you know, fish. It's offensive to me.
That and Diet Dr. Pepper, I'm just an addict.
Yeah, I accept Diet Dr. Pepper because it's almost sort of not entirely unlike regular Dr. Pepper.
I think that's the commercial. I heard that. That's part of their slogan. Yeah, entirely unlike.
Yeah. They say, you know, it tastes more like Dr. Pepper. More than what? Than dirt? Yes, it does taste more like it than dirt.
Truth in advertising.
Okay, well, for those of you watching the stream, I made a promise. No, not really a promise. I said if everything went well, I would be in a new studio tonight. You can see behind me that things are different. This is not a new studio. I just thought
your new studio was a couple of French doors with curtains on them.
My new studio is still in pieces. I am broadcasting from my dining room table. Hi, everybody. Welcome to my dining room. We have torn down PodPod 1.0, and all of the components of PodPod 2.0 are in place, but they are not yet assembled. Hopefully, I will be able to do that tomorrow. We had some bad weather delays, and we had some two guys who don't know what they're doing delays. And so now that's just the way it is. But all the panels are there and ready to go. They just need to be assembled. So hopefully next week I will be coming to you from my new studio.
Excellent. Looking forward to seeing that.
But as I told the audience on the show I did earlier tonight, I am now officially, truly, and really a redneck.
How's that?
I've been out in the sun the last couple of days building this thing, and my neck is sunburned and hurting, and I am a real redneck. Yes.
Extremely literal.
Yes.
Well, you're better than mine. I just don't go outside.
Well, ordinarily I don't. That's why this was such a big deal. You know, I have worked hard on this pasty face geek complexion.
Well, it's working for you.
So what's going on in your world this week, James?
Holy moly. It's been a busy weekend. It's
what a week it's been.
It's what a week it's been. You know, my podcast every week is called What a Week. Thank you for the plug. Usually on the weekends is where I get a lot of my production work done. So this weekend was a busy production week. Saturday was one where we did our normal podcast in the morning. In the afternoon, I did what amounted to what normally is a 60-minute study group. This one happened to be on Network Plus for the network certifications we do on Professor Messer. But this time it was up to almost 2 hours, like an hour and 50 minutes of work that we did that went into this with me talking the entire time. And then today I shot another 10 videos that now are in the hopper and have to go through post-production, which interestingly enough, might have something to do with what we are talking about today. So well, I certainly have a lot to communicate. And it brings up, I have this ongoing fear, this ongoing need, or this ongoing nagging about backups and doing, I'm sure you go through this as well with podcasts. I know that a lot of what you do is audio based, but still these are big files. They're important files to keep. I'm doing a ton of video. I looked at one of the videos today, and a single video that takes about 15 minutes to shoot is about 20 gig of disk space. So you have to keep that, though. That's your raw data before you do anything. And of course, you edit and work with it. And you have to store it somewhere so you can do something with it. And you have to have multiple copies of it. And so I've always gone through this process of manually backing things up. I have other pieces of it that I put on Dropbox that I'm not worried about somebody getting their hands on because of the inherent insecurities associated with cloud type systems. I have copies that I keep on multiple drives, but I'm almost ready to say it's time for a legitimate network accessible storage system, some type of NAS system that I can just plug into my gig Ethernet here and just have everything go to. And I don't know that I say that a lot. I've said that over and over again every few months, and I've never really pulled the trigger on it. I have a feeling it's coming soon. I've just got this nagging backup thing in the back of my head.
I have a poor man's NAS. It's a product called Pogo Plug. You may be familiar with
it. Oh, sure. Yep.
And so I have several drives connected to that I copy everything over to. I then copy things like the smaller things, the things that I would publish anyway, I put in Dropbox. And then I have everything go up. I'm trying to get everything up on BitCasa, but that's not going well for me. I have been going roughly 3 weeks now, and I'm at 75% of my upload to BitCasa.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Taking a while.
Yeah, it's not going well. But yeah, I too am looking. I want mine offsite. I've really been looking at like Amazon S3, but yep. And it's moderately expensive. It's not terribly expensive. It's moderately expensive.
Right. Yep.
But the issue is your bandwidth, and upstream bandwidth is always the Achilles heel of any home connection. And so, you know, it's like the same issue I'm having with BitCasa right now. When you're streaming up at 1.5 megabits, it takes a while to get a 20 gig file up there.
Sure. And for me, I create a 20 gig file every 15 minutes. So I sat down for a couple of hours. There's no way I could take all of that data and copy it out to the cloud and store it there. That type of solution just doesn't work for me.
Yeah, I have, I use at work a product called Drobo, which is an excellent
on-site NAS.
It's spendy, but it's worth it. And you know, I'm about as tightwad as you get. And if I'm willing to pay for it, it must be pretty good.
That must be pretty good. We'll have to talk after this is over, because of course I'm eyeing those as well and looking at what they have available over on the Drobo side. And that may be a viable alternative.
And of course, being a DIY kind of guy, you could do something with FreeNAS and just build your own. But I found when I was doing the numbers that buying good drives and buying good hardware, if I'm not just using crap laying around, you spend about as much as you would buying a NAS box. So I just decided to let somebody else do the work.
I think that's probably a good case for me as well, because I'm worried, because when we're shooting these podcasts and these videos that we do, sound is an important consideration. You don't see it in the video that we're showing on the live stream, but in front of me, well, maybe I can show, we can show, see some of it. In front of me is just massive curtains. There are curtains over half of this room. It's in the wall in front of me and the wall to my right. And that helps immensely. This microphone, of course, helps as well. But having that in the room is important. So I'm very sensitive to noises during my podcast. If I get any type of system, whether it's a mixer or a telephone or a set of speakers or hard drives or a NAS, has to be as quiet as possible.
Right. Or located somewhere else.
Or and I don't know what I would do then. I've got to put it somewhere. In my house, I have 3 children and 2 dogs. I don't know about putting it somewhere else.
Do they have basements there in Florida?
In this particular neck of Florida, they do. My house does not.
Yeah, where I live, you can't do a basement. The ground will eat your basement and your house right. will fall into it.
Ours in Florida, obviously, the water table is pretty close to the ground. Most of this is really at sea level, but I'm far enough inland that I actually could have a basement if I had a house that had one.
All right. So there you go. A little rambling about, and that is part of the show, sort of, the post-production. Once you've post-produced it, you've got all this stuff. And I don't know about you, James, but I keep all the raw data and all the edited data and the finished product too. Mm-hmm. I don't know why, but I do.
I'm finding that for my audio podcast that I've already gone through, I'm not as attached to that data as I am things that I'm creating for my training courses. Because when I shoot a video for the training course, it's generally immediately good. It's good. It's fresh and it's crisp and it has flavor for about 3 years because the exams tend to cycle through about every 3 years. Now it has some use after that. Just because 3 years has gone by doesn't mean that that technology isn't something that's useful to know. But generally after that, I have to create 3 more years worth of videos. So during that 3 year period, that content is just as valuable to me 3 years from now as it was the day I shot it. And I have to go through a number of post-processings to finally get the final product. So I don't want to have to do that over and over and over again. So it's very important that I keep that around.
And see, I always have this nagging fear that someday I'm going to want to sit down and pour through 200 plus shows and pull out little clips and do like a Christmas year in special or something. That's never going to happen. Maybe if someday when I get an intern, that'll happen, but I save it for that, you know, cause I don't want to go back to the pristine originals then, but honestly,
that's right.
Anytime I do listen to old stuff, I'm like, oh, I didn't know what I was doing back then. It's garbage. Why do I keep this anyway? But I still do because I'm neurotic about that.
Of course.
So, once you finish a show, let's talk a little bit, because I don't have any experience with this at all, about your video side of it. When you finish a show, or in your case, a class or a training video or something, mm-hmm. Yep. What are the steps you take post-production?
Well, it depends on what we're doing. So let's take an example. Let's take the most extreme example that's going to scare the pants off of you, which is the one where I'm creating a static training video anywhere from 5 to 10 minutes long on a particular topic. It's one that is done without anybody watching. There's no live stream. It's just me talking to a camera, a lot like I'm doing here. In fact, it's the same camera shot. So I would talk to my camera for 10 minutes. There are slides that I have on my screen. I record my screen, and at the same time, I'm recording on my camera. So already, the process of creating this training class has already created multiple input sources for the final video product. Then post-production begins. We finish that part. And tonight, I was doing exactly this. But before I can do editing on this, I have to do what I call a pre-rendering process of the video before I can even edit the video. So how you like that? I have to go through, and that's because my camera records at a certain set of frequencies of my audio. It records at a certain video rate that is different than what the software on my computer records at. So I have to take at least one of those video streams and re-encode it so that now it matches the other. Because when you're editing a video and audio together, especially multiple tracks, both of those tracks have to be very, very similar to each other in size and in scope and exactly the specifications. If they're not, you've probably seen this on YouTube where you get near the end of a YouTube video and the people talking and the audio is completely off. You ever see that?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Not only have I seen it, I've created it.
So you feel my pain. So in that particular case, that's somebody that pulled in an audio track and the audio track was set at a different speed than the video. And it's not something you notice near the beginning, but you notice because one is set to get sampling rates at 48,000 samples per second. The other one is set to get sampling rates at 44,100 samples per second. And so as time goes on, those samples become farther and farther apart. And now all of a sudden you've got everything out of sync. So what I do is this pre-rendering process just to get that done. That goes in. That takes about 3 times the amount of time that the video takes. So that could take another 30 minutes to get that done. Okay. Now.
Well, let me interrupt you there. Anybody on audio, if you're not recording on your editing device, we have to go through something similar. You know, some people like to record onto a standalone recorder rather than the computer or record on one computer, then you've got to find some way to get that off. Like if you're using, you know, a DAW like Pro Tools or something like that, you've got to render those clips down and then take it into something else. Or if you're just recording onto like a little Zoom recorder, you've got to move that. So that process is not unknown to the audio world as well. In my particular case, I record on the same computer I edit on. So it's not nice. An issue.
Not an issue. So you go right to the editing process as soon as the podcast is over.
Right.
So then, and that's finally, once I do my pre-rendering, I finally get to that point. And I put mine into the video editing software where I stick those two tracks together. I have my screen. I do a picture in a picture. We make some modifications of cropping and things if we have to make it look nice on the screen. We add some transitions and we render that one. So the editing process is finally done. And then the post-rendering process begins, because your video editing software, just as it was hard to get things into the video editing software, it's hard to get things out of the video editing software in the exact format that you would like. And specifically, and you've probably seen this as well, YouTube likes a certain kind of format with a certain kind of video size with a certain type of audio. Then if you go to blip.tv, it's a different format. If you're going to provide this video to somebody to watch on their computer, it's another different kind of format. If they're going to watch it on their iPhone or their Android device, it's another kind of format. So I have an automated process after I make my final rendered video that now goes through and chops it up into tiny little pieces and sticks it in all of those different formats.
And did you write this automation yourself?
The scripting of it, I wrote myself, but I'm using things that you can get for free. You can download. I use Handbrake a lot to do my video editing on my computer, because a lot of what I do is in an MP4 video format, and Handbrake handles MP4 extremely well. So I use that a lot. If I'm converting these to MP3, like my What a Week podcast, I take that video and I do have an audio feed of that. I will take something like FFmpeg, which is another type of scripting, another utility, great utility that will take a video file, pull out the audio, convert it to MP3 and save that as a file. So that's another part of the automation.
Yeah, FFmpeg is the Swiss Army knife of audio and video.
Oh, yes.
Whereas Handbrake is the Ginsu knife collection.
There you go.
It's a little higher level, but man, can it do some great stuff.
I use the command line version of Handbrake, which a lot of people don't even realize there is one, because they're so used to using the GUI. But there's a really nice command line version that I use,
which is essentially just FFmpeg with a few extra things added on.
Because that's
the engine that it uses.
That's right.
And so, my process, I'll go through what I do. It's much simpler. I don't do video. Yay. I just throw that out there. The Ustream video gets done all for me and I don't care. Yay.
Yay.
The audio, I record straight into Audacity. I save it. It's a project then, and that's it. I'm pretty well done. I said that I don't do anything else. The first thing I do is I make a copy. As soon as I save it, I copy it over to another computer. Just
right,
because that's what you got to do, especially if you're going to be, you know, editing. Never edit live. Never edit your only copy of something, because that's stupid. Just don't do it. That's my technical term for it. If you're out there and you're doing that, you're stupid or you're engaging in stupid behavior. How about that?
Don't go like that.
Yeah.
Don't do that.
So anyway, so I save it, I copy it, and then I do all my editing in Audacity. And for me, an hour show takes roughly 50 minutes to edit, but a lot of that 50 minutes is unattended time. I will run a compression filter on it, and that's going to take 3 minutes. And so I go do something else for 3 minutes. And then I run, something else, an amplification on it, and that's going to take a few minutes. And then, so that 50 minutes is probably only 20 minutes of active time. So sometimes my computer's not powerful enough to let me do two shows at once on it. But sometimes I'll have actually two computers going, doing two shows at once. But I try to do that myself. I try to do it as soon as possible. Even some of our shows, and we'll talk about this just a little bit, but I'll go ahead and move into it, is lead time. Some of my shows have 10 days between the day it's recorded and the day it's released.
Wow.
And some of them have 2 days. I think the shortest that I ever do is 2 days. But I know for your, like, What a Week podcast, your lead time is like an hour and a half. You get it out there really quickly, don't you?
Sometimes it does get out there very, very quick. When I'm dealing with a lot of audio or there's another event that I'm doing during the day, it's later on the day, but I try to get it out the same calendar day.
Yeah. And the reason that we chose to do that, and I think that's a question that everybody has to go through. I think if Steve were here, my impression of his stuff over the years is that he doesn't have, like, on Wednesdays this show comes out, on Thursdays this show, it's just whenever he gets it done, he releases it.
Yep.
But I like to do a scheduled release every Monday. Actually, nothing comes out on Monday. Every Tuesday, the Tightwad Teacher comes out. Every Wednesday, both the Art of Podcasting and Everyday Linux comes out. Every Thursday, the Tightwad Tech comes out. Every Friday, One Meal, One Workout comes out. Every Saturday, Periodic Table comes out. And I do that because those who aren't concerned with that won't care one way or the other. They'll just look, oh, I got a new episode. Those right. who, like me, are anal retentive will want that on that schedule. So that satisfies everybody. You're not ticking off the anal retentive people, yep. and the other people don't care anyway. So I have some scripts that I've written that schedule that out on the server side. So I finish my editing, I upload it to my server, and then at midnight on the given day, it's released and live.
Gotcha.
And also the show notes on the Drupal at midnight goes live. So,
gotcha.
And different people do that different ways. And the reason I like to have a lead time is just because, you know, I work 50, 60 hours a week and I have three kids and a wife. And mm-hmm. every now and then they like to encroach on my time. And I've been working on them about that.
How dare they?
And say, you know, hey, you know, leave me alone. I'm a podcaster now. I'm not a father anymore. Sorry, you lost. But so I don't always have a chance to sit down. And also, like, we're doing this show, we'll finish it up at 11:30. Or so my time, and I've got to be up for work at 5. I'm not gonna spend time tonight editing that.
Nope.
So I like to give myself at least a couple of days of lead time just to make sure that happens. And on some of them, it'll be a week or more, and that's just kind of how it worked out. Anytime I start a new show, I like to have two or three shows in the can before I release any of them. It's just I just like to do that because then it would be terrible to start a show and then have some technical glitch and the next week you can't do a show. So I like to make sure that I can build that up, and that builds up time for somebody to be sick. A lot of my shows depend on other people. With you, it's just you and your wife. So
right.
you can schedule those things a lot better, but I depend on other people. Like tonight, Steve's not here for whatever reason, maybe his power's out, who knows. But you know, if it was just Steve and me, we wouldn't be able to do a show. I'd have to wait and reschedule. And so that's why I like to build in a lead time.
Makes sense.
And so what about you? I know your stuff is a little different, but you try to do everything same day. Is that true for like your study sessions and those things? Do you put those out there, or are they just, they're one-time events and that's it? Or how does that work for you?
The study groups that we do are things that we do one a month. So these are pretty stretched far apart. There's a definite date and time we schedule. It's important that we get people there live because there's a lot of interactivity that we have. And it's a time where we just all show up once a month and we go through questions that people send in. So that's one that... there are a lot of people that can't make it because there are literally thousands of people who've signed up to be there, and we're just doing it on Ustream. Everybody can look, but it tends to be somewhere between 100, 150, 200 people, depending on the study group. So a lot of people, because of where they live in the world, they have a job, there's things they can't make it at that time on a Saturday at 1 p.m, or they're not interested in being there on a Saturday at 1 p.m, but they want to see the replay. So the instant that finishes, I'm getting emails asking, when is it available? When is it available? When is it available? So I try to work very quickly to get that video rendered, go through the editing process, which is much simpler because of the way we shoot that one, and get it out on YouTube so that everybody can see it.
So again, you try to shoot same day as much as possible?
As much as possible. It just makes for the type of content I have, it makes sense. Now for the videos, the training videos I shoot, I do those as I have time. So it may be the case that I've recorded, well, I did, I recorded 10 of them today. I have completed editing on two of them. None of them have been post-rendered to go up to YouTube, so they're not going to go out today. They'll probably go scattered out during the week. I'm traveling this week. I've got my laptop with me. I'll be editing, sticking things online, so they will trickle out one at a time over the next 7 days.
Just a quick side note. Isn't it amazing that you can do full-on audio and video editing on a laptop these days? You know, I'm old enough to remember when that took a big-time piece of hardware, and certainly not a little, you know, 10-pound or 10, not even 10-pound, 2-pound laptop that you carry.
Right. And the laptop I have, I bought just to go on the road with me so that I could do video editing if I wanted to. Now, laptop's not the best possible scenario for doing any type of editing. There are always limitations with the video card. There are limitations, well, mostly with the video card and with the front side bus inside of a laptop. You don't have the huge architectures and the speeds that you would have if you had a desktop machine, which is what I normally use at home. That's right. What we're watching this on.
And the hard drives are always slower, and it takes forever to render and save things every time.
That's true. So on this laptop, I got this laptop just for the process of doing video editing. So it has SSD inside of it. It has 8 gig of memory, and I got the fastest one I could in that laptop platform. So of course, if you've ever bought a laptop, that's good for, I don't know, 3.5 minutes.
Right.
And then the new version comes out and it's slow. So my goal is to maybe upgrade here eventually, but I bought it for that level of speed because laptops have so many limitations when it comes to those things.
Hey, when you're ready to throw that out, throw it my way because it's okay, better than sure. anything I've got.
I made a decision early on, and this is more of a business decision than it was anything else, but it is a leased laptop. So I recognize that it's not going to be good to me in 2 years. In 1 year, this is not good to me anymore. It's a video editing system.
Right.
It's already leapfrogged 12 months from now. I already recognized early on, there's nothing I can do with this when I'm finished. I'm just sending it back and they'll give me another one. Done.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about the tools that you use. We mentioned last week or the week before that you use Wirecast for your setting up your camera shots and all that sort of stuff. What do you do to actually save and then post-produce the video?
One of the things that's, I have two systems that I use. I have one for my live events. That would be my What a Week podcast and my study group sessions. And even this, to some degree, you're really doing most of the production, but the video that people are watching online on the live stream right now is the Wirecast stream. So I can flip around using my Wirecast. I'm simply using a camera redirector inside of this to take the Google Hangout that we're on and redirect that into the Wirecast piece so I can pop myself up. I can put lower thirds. I can do the effects that I would normally do with some of the pictures in a picture and the other things that I would put in here, or maybe logos that I would put up. Those things are all in the Wirecast and I can work with those and manipulate them. Wirecast has a way built into the software for you then to simply, as you're doing this and flipping around and you saw the sort of the moving of the cameras, where you just click a button, it records it. And at the same time, if you wanted it to, it would also stream it out to another location. So I can click a button, it starts broadcasting on Ustream and starts saving all of this information to the hard drive in a big video file.
See, I made a crushing mistake when I set up doing this podcast. And that is every time we do a show, I have to go buy something. And it was, I should never have done this show for that very reason. I now have a DBX 266 XL nice. Compressor limiter because you guys raved about it and I had to go buy it. So now I'm going to have to go get Wirecast because you're raving about it.
Wirecast, it was probably one of the more expensive things I've ever bought. It is not a cheap piece of software, but I think the retail price on it's like $450. So it was a significant investment. It's one where we had to sit around the table and go, well, is this going to make sense for what we're going to do? Well, what are we going to do with it? Well, we'll do these study groups, we'll do a podcast, and there's other things we have in the hopper that as we can change the course of time and space and provide more time during the day, I'll be able to also get those things done too. But we thought of this as a business investment in what we were doing, so it made sense to purchase that software. There is a less expensive version of Wirestream that is, if you've ever seen it on Ustream, it's the Ustream Presenter. Have you ever seen that?
I have.
So that is, it's not very expensive at all, I don't think, relatively speaking.
I think it's about $100.
$150, somewhere in there. That is a pared down version of Wirestream, and it works just with Ustream. So if all you're doing is Ustream, and it will save to disk, it has the multiple camera angles, it works with the microphones, it's the same thing, except it's just for Ustream, and it's made by the same people, and they support it the same way. It's a great little piece of software.
Yeah, the reason I didn't purchase that originally is I didn't have the ability to do a side-by-side shot. I wanted to do the Brady Bunch thing.
And if I've got
four guests on, I want to line them all up. And all I can do is a picture in picture, a big guy and a little guy.
Right.
So I use a tool when I do that. I haven't done that in a while, but I used a Linux-based tool called Webcam Studio, which is super powerful and super unstable and super alpha and mostly broken. But when it works, man, is it awesome.
Gotcha.
So that's... Gotcha. Right now, I think I mentioned this live. It might have been before we started recording. But the way I do video for this show right now is, as James mentioned, we hop in a Google Hangout, and Google shows us all the video there. There's a big video screen. I use ManyCam to capture that off the desktop. And when I want to switch cameras, I just click on James, and now we're looking at James. And then when I click it again, I click on me. And so, and that works, and it's free. And, you know, because I'm not producing video content, it's good enough. What I don't have is any ability to save this right now. I don't have the tool to save that locally. It's saved on Ustream, but, you know, highly compressed and pretty low quality. also, it has, you know, issues with, occasionally the audio and video gets wildly out of sync. And also, Google will very annoyingly pop up a message every now and then that says, "Are you still here?" "Why, yes, I am. Go away. You're impinging on my stream." But I can't complain too much that I'm using a free product.
One of the things that I came across very early, and I've been doing video with video editing for a number of years now, and it became very clear very early that video is hard. It's difficult to do. It is trial and error, but mostly error. There's so many different requirements, because now that we're doing video, I have to think about what shirt I'm wearing. Do I decide I have to get my lights going that I have in my studio right now? I've got to make sure that my audio system and my video system are synced up and receiving the information they should be. And because I'm showing you things on my screen and other things that I'm working on, for instance, I was showing the Wirecast software by flipping over to that screen and showing those capabilities. I have to have that available and show it. And all of this is live, and we're flipping around, and all of those things apply. So that becomes a huge challenge. Plus, of course, we already talked that the files are enormous when you're done with this. Right. That it, and as the chat room appropriately says, you have to put pants on when you're doing this now. It's not like an audio podcast, which is important as well. So those types of things you have to think about before going into it. And the software makes a huge difference, because if your video software isn't good, your editing software or the capture software you're using isn't any good, then you're going to have problems. And I mentioned Wirecast as a product that's $449 for the basic version. The advanced version is another $450-something or $500 on top of that. That's a significant amount of money, but it's hard to find things that do this very well. And Wirecast is one of those that does it very, very well. There's a number of others that do it as this type of thing with Wirecast. I can probably pull those names up here eventually, but I need something that works well, and I'm willing to pay a little bit more if I know I don't have to go through a lot of suffering.
Right. And $1,000 is expensive when you think about purchasing a piece of software. But when you compare that to, say, going out and getting a hardware TriCaster,
holy moly.
It's dirt cheap.
Yeah. Because you're talking, they're starting at $7,500, $10,000 just for a piece of hardware you plug your cameras into that does all of this.
Yeah. So expensive is a relative term. For, you know, for just writing that check, it feels pretty darn expensive. But when you consider what it can do for the price, it's really a bargain basement sort of thing.
It's one of those things where now I've had it a number of months. I use it constantly. I use it for this podcast. It is now become an invaluable tool for what I use. So the investment in my particular case was a good one.
Yeah. Okay. So the next thing I had is music. Now for me, bump music is very important because I'm a music guy. I got my start in live music production and in studio recording, and I'm a musician. So I find it important, critically important, that there be good music to begin and end the show. It sets the tone for the show. I listen to a number of podcasts that just start out with a guy saying, "Hi, everybody," and then they go. And then when he's over, he says, "Good night," and then that's it, and there's no music. And every time that happens, I feel like I've just fallen into a sinkhole. It's like there was no transition. There was no nothing. So I find that to be important. I don't like beds of music behind people talking, you know, the whole traffic report sort of feel to it. But I understand that a lot of people do that. And I do a lot of sound effects, and, you know, I don't have a soundboard and a whistle when somebody makes a joke. I don't do that. Again, I know that that is an appeal to people. But for me, I take in a piece of music I like. Usually it's a heavy guitar piece just because I like that. And I don't really care if you don't. It's my show. No, I'm kidding. I do care. I'm just not going to change it.
Sure.
So I go out and find that. And you either have to license it or you find something that's Creative Commons. And the cross-section on a Venn diagram between music that's Creative Commons and good music is a very, very narrow little loop there. There is some, but you have to work really hard to find it. And so I go to places like Podcast Music Alley or Jamendo or those things, and I will decide this Saturday I will spend 10 hours sorting through crappy music to find a couple of good ones.
It's hard to find good music.
Right. It is. Because, you know, those people are giving away music, and oftentimes it's music that's not worth paying for. It's some guy in his bedroom just jamming for fun. And
right.
I'm fine with that. But every now and then you'll find somebody who releases like an entire old album or a project that didn't get finished. And you'll have, a professional quality musician that just releases something that wasn't marketable for whatever reason. And so those are good things. And then you can license music. And often, in fact, I've had this on three separate occasions for shows I do. I just email the artist and say, "Hey, I want to use a minute, 45 seconds of your song for this podcast. Are you okay with that?" And I'll get back an email from either the author or artist or their A&R rep, and they'll say, "Sure, go right ahead." And so now you have officially licensed that music, and it doesn't cost anything.
I'm one of these guys that wants to have music. If you've ever seen the latest videos that I do, the training videos I do that are online on YouTube, absolutely free, anybody can watch, there's no music on them. None at all. I'm that guy that you get 3 minutes of silence on the title, and then we go into content. And 3 minutes of 3 seconds of silence at the beginning, 3 seconds of silence on the back end.
3 minutes, I'd be turning you.
That'd be something, wouldn't it? That's compelling training right there, let me tell you. And I used to have music in my videos. You used to have bumper music at the beginning and the end. And I started getting emails from people that were stationed in Germany, especially in U.S. Armed Services. Or people that were in Germany that were German natives that were sending me emails and saying, YouTube has blocked your videos here. I can't see them. I thought, why? I don't know. I didn't say anything disparaging that had anything to do with German. My name is of German descent. I can certainly appreciate I love to go to Munich.
You like German beers?
I love the German beers. So I'm all with you. But in Germany, there is an organization that's very much like the RIAA in the United States. They're called I have it up here on the screen, the GEMA, the GEMA. They are the ones that represent the musical artists in Germany. And they found that people were putting German music into YouTube videos and they weren't getting paid on it. And so they forced YouTube to take any video that has any type of music at all in the video and remove it, make it blocked inside of Germany if you're watching those videos. So there was a huge number of people that wanted to see my training. I'm doing this training for free so that people all around the world could watch it and learn something and get their certifications or get a better career or do something with what they want to do with that knowledge. And there's huge amounts of people in Germany just had no access to it because of that. So it's unfortunate that adding that music caused a problem. So now I just don't put any music into it, which I don't like. I'd like to put music into it, but I don't have that choice. So occasionally having that music in there might bite you a little bit.
Right. So it's just any music? They don't even ask? They just, music, it's banned?
I use music that I have purchased for the express purpose of putting into these videos. It's licensed. It's stock music that I get from a stock music source. They're all, if you go to, just type in stock music at in the Google prompt, you'll get tons of places and you can buy these tracks for $10, $20, $30 a piece. And use them however you would like. They are now available free to use without having to pay any royalties every time you use them. And it doesn't matter whether you have paid for them, whether they are legitimate, whether they are something that has been licensed properly or not. If it has music in it, it is blocked.
Okay. I'm going to refrain from commenting on that because I've already called half of our listeners stupid, so I won't insult an entire country.
it is this certain little organization. Well, it's the music organizations, and we're all struggling with this. We all have our own problems with the RIAA and the MPAA in the United States. Well, it's not something that's local to just the United States.
Right. Yeah. And unfortunately, in this litigious age, it's very important that you cover your bases. And, you know, if you're a musician, write your own stuff. Well, that's great. But even though that still, that would be blocked in Germany, wouldn't it? Even if you
wrote your own music. Yes. If you are, in my particular case, my business model is I want people to watch my videos. If they watch my videos, I can keep doing more of them. There's a revenue stream that comes from that. So if I'm making this something that has that revenue stream associated with it and it has music in it, that's when it's blocked in Germany. And I want people to see it all over the world. That makes business sense for me, and it's advantageous for people to be able to see it because it's free training. So I just don't put any music in.
Well, there you go.
It's kind of a bummer.
Yeah, it is.
Sorry. Kind of bringing everybody down, man.
But since I don't put anything on YouTube, I'm pretty safe.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know other online streaming, those organizations like Blip, like Vimeo, they probably don't even have to go through this because they don't have that level of visibility that YouTube has. But I don't want to have to make all these things with music in it and try Vimeo to do this. Then they cut off Vimeo. It's just not what I'm trying to do.
Yeah. Before we do a show, I always have the stream up and running just to let people know that it's actually there, especially if we're running late. You know, they like to get there and I always play some music and, I play it off of my phone, and it's just a collection of Creative Commons music that I've found, and some of it's really good, some of it's just okay, but it's good enough for background music just to let people know the stream is up.
Exactly.
Okay, so, you know, there's that. Coming from the standpoint of a musician, I think music is very important, but as a pure businessman, it can be sort of a no-brainer not to do it. I mean, James would be pretty dumb to include music and limit an entire country from gaining access to his stuff.
And you want to be very careful if you're planning to use music in your podcast, just make sure it's licensed properly. It's something that people are happy about hearing, about something that that they're not going to have a problem with hearing, that the artist is not going to have a problem with you using. Just check the licensing to make sure you don't run into any legal problems.
Yeah, we have a listener in the chat room who makes a point that says the same music can be annoying if you have to hear it over and over. Like your training videos were 7 or 10 minutes. If somebody's listening to 15 or 20 of those on a long drive, I could see how that could get pretty annoying to hear the same music all the time.
Sure. It's one of those things you do have to be careful about because I used to do videos that were about 20 to 25 minutes in length. So I take multiple topics and cram them together. Now I'm trying to do much smaller videos that are a single topic. And so they're about 4, 5, 10 minutes long max. And that could get, that would annoy me after, right. after a while, much less anyone else.
Yeah. My clips tend to be, a minute to, or less, per an hour show. So, you know, mm-hmm. In terms of proportion, it's pretty small.
And don't even remember what I listened to back then.
And it's funny. I had somebody recently tell me, that the music is their cue to know that they don't care to hear the rest of it. So that's when they turn it off. Cause that's when I'm going to say, you know, this is where you can find us and go to our website and the stuff that I say every show anyway. So as soon as I hear the music, okay, the content's over. I can turn
Well, at least they didn't tell you it was the introduction. That was their cue.
Yeah, that would, some cases that might be wise. okay. So, when you're doing an audio show and James, I know that you do, What a Week in audio format. Mm-hmm. I'm curious though, is that, something that you consider important or is it just an afterthought?
It is a complete afterthought. I don't consider the audio aspect of it. I don't build it with the audio aspect involved. I simply convert it to audio because there may be people that don't want to watch it, but I don't do things like think about I'm showing because we show a lot of things on the screen. We do a lot of demonstrations and watch this video and look at what we're looking at here. And I don't describe it. I don't go into details about the mind's eye. I don't do any of those things. So it's more of a convenience thing. And at the end of the day, it probably isn't a good thing that people have to sit there and listen to that. But it's one of those that it's so easy to do. Why not throw it out there?
And I subscribe to a couple of dozen different podcasts. And some of them are video podcasts. And even the ones where I download the video, Hack 5 comes to mind. It's as far as I know, it's video only. I don't think they have an audio feed of it. But I will have my phone face down on the desk. I'm just listening mm-hmm. to it anyway. And yep. It annoys me when a host or a collection of hosts will spend 10 or 15 minutes talking about something on the screen or walking through something when it's an audio podcast. Now, I understand if I'm just getting the audio of a video podcast, that's my choice. But there are some shows that it's an audio podcast. It's obviously an audio podcast, and they still spend all their time talking about what's on the screen. And I think my point there is you just have to pay attention to what you're doing. You know, right now you and I are seeing each other, and you can put something on the screen, and I can see it, and I can put something on the screen, and you can see it. But yep. You know, and the 10 people who are watching live can see it, but the 1500 people who download it later, they're out of the loop. And so you want to pay attention to your audience when you're doing that sort of stuff.
And here, let me move this out of the way. Oh, wait, you can't see that.
Right. and so when you're doing your video, again, my whole business at this point is audio. Mm-hmm. So, there are certain things that I have to make, take care of. So once I've got everything, mixed and ready to go, I'm going to render that down to an MP3 file. So I'm also going to make sure that MP3 file is very carefully tagged so that, iTunes and other MP3 players can know what to do with it. I'm going to include an image in that, the album art. And right. I haven't started it yet, but I'm probably going to start including much larger album art for devices like the new iPad, which doesn't, mm-hmm. but don't call it the iPad 3. It's just an iPad. Because of that new highly touted Retina display, my 300x300 album art has to get stretched so much on their device that it's really small. Or, you know, if you've got even my phone here is a 1080p essentially display.
Right.
And so 300 pixels out of 1080 pixels is pretty darn small. So, you really gotta pay attention to that sort of thing. And for years, the iTunes album art size, they said was 300. And I think for a while, iTunes wouldn't even accept anything over 300.
Right.
And then people started saying, well, do 500x500. And now I really think probably 1200x1200 is the way to go, or maybe even bigger, and it does make your file size larger. But again, in the context of an hour show, that's going to be 30 megs. That right. extra 500K isn't going to bother anybody.
Drop in the bucket.
Right. So I do all, do that. I mix it down. I make sure all the tags are right. And then I prepare it for the automated process of being distributed. So, what care do you take in yours? I mean, I assume you go at least go ahead and do the album art stuff on your audio podcast, right?
I do. And there is also an option to at least have the album art there for the beginning of the video. As you're looking at a static screen on your mobile device, you can see the album art there as well. And it's just loaded up into, I use an RSS management program called Feeder in Mac OS 10 that allows me to do that and put it in there. For me, it's the podcasts, I just kind of throw out there, we're doing them live. If we say or ah, or I drop something and you hear background noise, we just keep going. It's a live event. Everybody understands this as we're going through this process. You don't go back and necessarily edit any of those things. You don't change it. And there certainly won't be a need 6 months from now to go back and change those things either. Right. It's just the podcast is done and it's out there. For my training videos, though, I make mistakes all the time. And you stick a training video out there, you don't want mistakes in a training video. But as you're talking, you're on your 10th video, you're saying something, and you meant to say 300, and you said 500. And then you put the video out there, and I would estimate about 1 million people send me emails that say, duh, you said 500. That's really 300.
And they all start out with, you're such an idiot.
And I'm fine with that. Bring it on. Because you know what? That's one of the things I love about the internet, love about doing what I do, is that if I screw something up, everybody else tells me, and then I can fix it. And though I go back to my raw video, or sometimes I reshoot, sometimes I change it in post, sometimes I just do a voiceover. I change that, edit, stick it back out there, delete that bad one, stick the new one out there. It just makes for better training videos. This is awesome. I get immediate feedback, or I get, sometimes these go on for months and somebody months later says, did you mean to say 300? Like, wow, it's been sitting there for months and people have had that go by. Let me go back and correct that. So I have to go through this QA process. Whenever I finish a video, I go back during the video editing process. I'm not just looking for gaps. I'm not just looking for the markers in my video to go in and do some transitions. I listen to every word all over again. So it's delightful, the process. Right. But I know when I go through it that it's not one of those situations where I stopped, I repeated something, because I'll do 2 and 3 takes at one time for a single section of the video. And so if I miss one of those, you end up having to watch that take and then you have to watch the take again. And you don't want that in there. You want to edit all those things out. So for me, it's very, very important, that QA process of listening to what's there, going through it, and then sometimes months later, going back and doing the whole thing again. So unlike a traditional podcast like What a Week, I'm throwing it out there. I'm not going to go back to the November episode. I do that all the time with my training videos.
Right. Yeah. And that was one of the things that we were going to talk about, is the level of post-production continuity fixes. And I talked a little bit recently about, you know, some of my tips for fixing when my internet provider decides to drop us.
Right.
Which, knock on wood, hasn't happened tonight.
Yes.
But there are things that you have to do. And I know some shows are very careful about cutting out every time somebody stammers or says, or whatever. And more power to them. It does make a better product. I cannot argue with the fact that it makes for a more professional, better product in the end. But it's just not something, you know, I'm doing 6 shows a week on average. An hour to an hour and a half per show. So I'm looking at between 6 and 9 hours a week of audio that I have to do that with. So not only am I doing it, now I'm going back and listening to it, and then I'm editing it, and then I'm listening to it again. And it's just not in a time manner. It's not cost productive for me to do that. So I don't, but I do take out the glaring errors, you know. So you gotta go there. And I know, so the other shows that are, you know, totally live. You know, the one of the biggest names in podcasting, Leo Laporte, I've heard him have a full conversation where he thought the mic was off, while the other guest is talking and trying to concentrate. And he doesn't go back and edit that. He just leaves it. And I wonder, is that a conscious decision, or does his workflow just not even allow for that? Maybe it's both. Maybe he made the conscious decision to create a workflow that doesn't allow for that.
Well, that's live television, right? Or live podcasting, or whatever we're calling that thing.
Yeah. But the thing is, it's not live. And I like to take advantage of the fact that it's not live and make it, you know, a little better than it actually was live if I can.
I think there's something to be said for that.
Yeah. Okay. So the next thing is automation. We talked a little bit about that already, but I want to hear what James does specifically, and I'll talk a little bit about what I do specifically. So what can you automate, and what do you recommend other people automate, and what has to be done manually?
Gosh, my configuration is probably pretty unique, but the tools that I use are pretty common. One of the things that I do most everything on is Mac OS X. I used to run everything on a Windows 7 system, so I've run those in both types of environments. And the one thing that is common throughout all of them is you have to have a good conversion program, whether it's audio conversion or video conversion. If you're doing video podcasts, you need a good conversion program. One of the struggles I have is that I have so many different video sources and different operating systems and different limitations of the software inside of those operating systems, which exist no matter what OS you're going to use, that I have to have multiple conversion programs to do what I need to do. So I will use things like in the Apple world, Apple has a video editing or video conversion program called Compressor, which is different than audio compressors, which we've talked about before. The name of this is Compressor, and it's one that will take different video formats and convert them to others. It's primarily Apple focused. So it's a lot of the editing formats that you would run into, like AIC or the other high-end non-compressed video format type things you run into. So that's important for me because a lot of the software I use is on that Mac. On the audio side, we've already talked about Handbrake and we've talked about FFmpeg, which are fantastic applications. Not only Handbrake, if you are used to doing this from a graphical interface, they have a great graphical interface, which is really hard to find with some of these programs that convert this software around. Interestingly enough, one of the most powerful out there is FFmpeg, and FFmpeg is a command line product. It doesn't have a graphical front end. Some people have made some graphical front ends for it, but they're all miserable. They're all horrible. So nobody uses them. And everybody does it at the command line. If you're good at the command line, well, you can make those programs dance. So you can slide a video or audio file into it and chop it up and mix it up and make it in this format and make it in that format and pull the audio out of a video and make it in this MP3 format and have it ready to go right out the door.
Yeah. And then once you script all that, you do the hard work once and it's automated every time thereafter.
It's not easy to script these things, whether you're in a Windows command line environment or in the Mac OS X environment, which is effectively a BSD bash shell type scripting environment, or of course, very similar on the Linux side to be able to do that in a bash shell and use Perl or just use the standard scripting language. It's not easy to get that done. I literally was tweaking these scripts this weekend because I wanted to do something different, handle the file names differently. And how do I parse those out? And you're doing tons of research on the internet just for a little 6-line script that you just wanted to put an MP4 at the end instead of the MOV and don't append it. And I'm going to throw something through my screen. That's what you run into, but that's kind of the normal part. But once you get it, now you've got a very nice flow. You click a button, it does everything for you.
Yeah, you were talking about GUIs. There's a tool on the Windows side that I always begrudgingly recommend. It's called Super, just S-U-P-E-R.
Okay.
And it's a put anything you want in and get anything you want out program. Uh-huh. Very powerful. But the GUI was designed by 3 blind men who had been hospitalized and put through electroshock therapy. It's just
at night.
Yeah. It is a horrible, horrible interface. It's ugly. It's clunky. It's difficult. You've got a right click here, but to do the same thing somewhere else, you hold, click and hold. And to do someplace somewhere over here, you double click. Yeah. You can look at their website that James has up. Just the website alone is enough
awful.
To blind you.
It's horrible.
And so and it's like 17 clicks just to figure out how to download it. And then once you get to it, you find that the program itself looks just that bad.
Wow. But it does.
But it works good. Looks bad, works good.
That's the key. As long as it looks like it has tons of things that it does. There's this enormous list of video and audio and output options, which is what you're looking for. And for those of you that have dealt with conversion programs, you know, it's a little rough around the edges. You're willing to deal with it.
Yeah, it's simple. It's basically FFmpeg, but with everything FFmpeg can do in buttonized.
Nice.
And you know all the stuff FFmpeg can do, that's a lot of buttons.
Right.
And they just, yep. You know, if they'd spent, you know, a day, an afternoon, just make a lunch appointment with a graphic designer, it would have changed everything. But
that's at erightsoft.com, erightsoft.com.
So yeah, just be warned if you go there. So in terms of automation, in again, I use Audacity as my editor, and Audacity has a fairly powerful macro engine where you can can build things, but I don't like it for a couple of reasons. Let's say, for example, I want to amplify something, and I want to say I want to make its volume zero. I want to raise the max volume to 0 dB instead of, you know, negative whatever. Okay. It will amplify however much it has to get to zero. That's kind of cool. If I go to the next track and repeat that, it brings that up by the same value. So if it is louder or softer, it amplifies by the same value instead of whatever it takes to get to zero.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And so if you do the compression, the same sort of thing, you can tell it to do that. And whatever you set it at, it goes, okay, that's what you want me to do everywhere. So the macro capabilities are really good. They're just, yeah, they're just a little, you know, they're 98% there.
A little bit.
And so it's enough that I do everything manually in Audacity. But as I mentioned before, once I have the MP3 file finished, I put that up and I use a tool called Podcast Generator. Open source guys aren't always very creative with their names, but that's the name of it, Podcast Generator. And that's a whole separate thing from my Drupal. I know a lot of people like to use the RSS features of their Drupal or their WordPress, but I like to have a different feed, and it's just a preference thing. So I can put a blog or whatever else entry. I hate it when my MP3 player tells me there's a new episode and I go click on it and it's just a blog post somebody wrote.
And they
get mixed in with the same feed. So I keep everything separate, and I have kept, and even though Podcast Generator allows different categories, I don't do that. I have a different instance of the program every time, just because that's the way I like to do things.
Yep.
And so I have, I hacked the code on it a little bit. It's, you know, a little PHP, so it wasn't all that hard. And, I load everything up into a directory called Media Pre-Release, and I can just put that up there, 10 years in advance if I want. And then there's a cron job that runs. I know I'm getting really geeky here. There's a cron job that runs on the given night. So if the show releases, like this show, for example, releases on Wednesday. So Wednesday at midnight, the cron job fires, and it takes anything that was in that folder, moves it to the actual folder, and reruns the RSS feed thing. So I can automate that. And I used to do all that manually, and I would literally forget to do a show. You know, again, busy life, work long hours. I would get up on Thursday morning and get to work, and there'd be an email from somebody saying, no show today? Oh, God, I forgot to do that.
Whoops.
So I looked at ways of automating that. So I highly recommend that you find or create or in somehow come across a way to automate the publishing thing if you intend to do things on a schedule. And in terms of the actual editing, I think you never get as good a results as when you do it manually. So you can automate things, but if you really want to maximize it, you can, how many times am I going to say you have to do it manually. Like you were talking about the video, you make markers. And you could probably construct some way to go through and everywhere there's a marker, delete what's in between, but that's nowhere near the same as actually editing a show.
Correct.
Right, great commentary on that one.
You're very welcome.
And that's really all I had in the show notes. Did you have anything else you wanted to add or delete?
One great thing about having collaboration on Google Docs is that you want to delete something or yell about something, it's there and immediate. No, I think that was a good overview. That obviously a lot of what we both do is a lot of in the weeds kind of technical details. And we've really just given a very broad overview of what's going on. And it might be worthwhile in a future episode to go through these pieces, take just one aspect of it and show compressor or show FFmpeg or go through those pieces of it to show how easy or how difficult it might be to use it for you.
Already on the list of things to do.
Fabulous.
Because I think you mentioned it once before. So well, let's move on to the what you learned this week. And okay. James, I will let you start. Go first on that one.
One of the things I did this week is, as I've already mentioned, I do these live study groups once a month. This week was a study group for Network Plus, and I used a new interactivity tool for the people that were joining the live feed. They don't have a way to call in interactively. I do have a chat room. It's very much what we're doing here on our live feed. There is video, so you can see what I'm doing, and I can bring up my screen so you're able to see my screen, and I've got the Wirecast that does a lot of that for me. And we have a chat room that I'm constantly monitoring to see what are people saying. Are they asking questions? Do they have comments about some of the things I've said? And I'll go to them and we'll talk about that piece. But I wanted something else. So, and you may want to integrate this into either your audio or your video podcast because it will work in either way. And it's a product called Poll Anywhere. I don't know. Have you ever seen this?
Yeah, it's big in schools.
Right. They do a lot of this for schools because you can be in a room full of people and ask a question or give a poll question, and you can SMS the answer out to them, which is kind of nice. So one of the things that I did was make polls, or in some cases, they were me wanting to get a question from somebody like, what topic do you want to cover on next week's study group? And it would pop up that message, and they can use their phone and SMS the answer in, or they can go through and tweet it to @poll, or they can submit it via the webpage, which is what most people did there's a URL you give them that's very short, and they could slide those things in, and they immediately, you start to see the results on the screen. I also did a lot of questions that were like sample questions for an exam. You have this problem, which one of these is the answer? And people would vote on what that answer was. And you can collect the answers and then sort of display them all at once, or you can show the screen and see the interactivity as people are sending in their response. So if you're looking for another twist on a live event that you are doing, that Poll Anywhere might be a good solution for you.
At the school where I work, we use that at lunchtime in the cafeteria. It keeps the kids bonafide and out of trouble. There's
nice.
A quiz running just on a slideshow. And like the person who gets the most answers gets a special prize or something. So it becomes a competition. And so they're using their phones, they're Googling things, and then they're responding and they're not getting in trouble.
And it's, I misspoke. The name of it is PollEverywhere.com.
Yeah. Well, there's also a Poll Anywhere. Both sites exist.
There is as well. The Poll Everywhere is the one that I used. So an example is one that I gave sort of as a test for people to do, which was, the question was pirates, ninjas, robots, aliens, or zombies. And, we came up with a tie. 30% of the folks said robots, 30% said zombies, and then pirates, ninjas, and aliens came up on the end.
I see. I would be at the end there because I would be aliens.
I was in ninjas. So ninjas. I came in next to last.
All right. And so the thing that I learned this week, and again, it's not something I learned this week, but it's something that was reiterated in my life. And that is a simple quote I heard one time: everything takes longer than you think. You know, and the fact that I'm broadcasting from my dining room table is testament to the fact that everything takes longer than you think. Whatever you think you're going to do, add 50% of your time and then add another 25%, because everything takes longer than you think. I tend to be a very organized, time-centric person. I plan my day. My Google Calendar is full of stuff, and I build in what I call idiot time. It's time for me to be an idiot and still be on time to an appointment. So, you know, it's where I can just totally make a wrong turn or just yep. completely space on it. So I build in my idiot time, but sometimes even that doesn't work. So just know that whatever you think, you're wrong.
That's kind of the Scotty from Star Trek type of estimation of yes. time, isn't it?
Yes. 3 days. You've got 15 minutes. Okay.
Exactly.
All right, so James, where could people find out about your wonderful sites that we've shows and videos and stuff and words coming out of my mouth that we've been talking about for the last hour?
You can visit everything I have at two primary places. Our weekly podcast of What a Week can be found at whataweekpodcast.com. You can find all of the videos there. You can also see links there to download and subscribe to the podcast in iTunes and other RSS type readers. And of course, all of our free videos for all of those industry training courses can be found at ProfessorMesser.com.
And for all your podcasting needs, go to ElementOP.com and check out the Art of Podcasting forums. You can ask us questions. You can make comments. You can call me an idiot. I'm fine with that. You can tell James that he meant 300 when he said 500.
Sure. Absolutely.
So, ElementOP.com is a place to go there. And we, you know, as I've mentioned earlier, I do a lot of other shows. You might like some of them. And go check that out. And if Steve were here, I'm sure he would encourage you to go to howtopodcast.biz and check out his 10-plus hours of online video training that tells you everything you need to know, and more than that, everything he knows about how to do a podcast. So, Steve, you got your plug in and you weren't even in. And so, without further ado, I guess I'm going to say that ends this episode of The Art of Podcasting.